So now I have $4 and 40 cents.
Good afternoon. I'd like to bring the House Committee on Business and Labor to order today. We have one public hearing today. I'm going to move through just a quick little introduction, work session, and one bill to move out of committee before I start the public hearing. So with that, I will open a work session for the introduction of committee measures. Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Holvey, I move that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 3894, dated February 20th, 2017.
Representative Barreto moves that LC 3894, dated February 20th, 2017, be introduced as a committee bill. Is there discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? The bill is adopted as a committee bill. And I'll close that work session for committee measures and open a work session on House Bill 2359.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is a measure that the committee heard February 8th. It's a bill that comes to you from the Attorney General. It removes the requirement that the beneficiary send to the AG a copy of the notice that goes to the homeowner informing them that they are not eligible for a foreclosure avoidance measure or that the homeowner has not complied with the terms of a foreclosure avoidance measure. There are no amendments before you. There is no revenue impact to the bill. There's no expenditure impact to the bill. And that is it.
Representative Barreto.
Chair Holvey, I move House Bill 2359 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barreto moves House Bill 2359 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? None. Kayla, can we have a roll call vote, please?
Aye.
Representative
Evans?
Yes.
Representative Fahey?
Aye.
Representative Pack?
Aye.
Representative Hurd?
Yes.
Representative Kenemer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barreto?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Bynum?
Aye.
Chair Holvey?
Aye. House Bill 2359, having received the required votes, is passed to the floor. I'll close the work session on House Bill 2359. And we will not be moving the other three bills that are on the work session agenda today. So with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2005. Mike Carrier on the last bill we will assign.
Mr. Chair and committee members, House Bill 2005 makes it an unlawful employment practice to discriminate against employee based on protected class when paying wages or other compensation. It provides that the employer may pay a different wage for equal work based on merit, seniority, productivity, or bona fide factors such as education, training, or experience if certain criteria are met. It makes an unlawful employment practice to screen the applicant based on their salary history or to determine compensation based on the applicant's or the employee's salary history. And it provides the employee with a choice to file a complaint with the Commissioner of Labor and Industries or to file a suit for alleged pay equity violations. Provides additional remedies for pay equity violations that include the right to compensatory and punitive damages, extends time limitation to bring a claim to make actionable each subsequent payment of wages that's based on an underlying pay equity violation, and extends the tort claim notice from 180 days to 1 year for public employees that are alleging a pay equity violation. And finally, it protects seniority rights for employees who are on sick leave or family medical leave. Today, there are no amendments before you.
Thank you. And up first, we have a few legislators coming up. So Representative Lively, if you would be so kind to drag another chair up.
I would be. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Just introduce yourself for the record. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. I'm Ann Leininger, representing Lake Oswego in Southwest Portland, as representative for House District 38. I'm pleased to be here today with colleagues to introduce to you House Bill 2005. We will be followed up by a panel of experts who can address some of your more specific questions, but we wanted to frame the issue. I would like to frame the issue by noting that pay discrimination is still a real problem. And here are a couple examples. The U.S. women's national soccer team. The women's national soccer team brought in more revenue and won more games than the men's team in 2015, but they were paid substantially less. The women were also given a smaller per diem, and sponsor appearances. Silicon Valley. In 2015, men with a degree in Silicon Valley earned between 52% and 61% more than women with the same level of education. Journalists at the Wall Street Journal, Barron's, and MarketWatch. At the end of 2015, men earned 13.5% more than women at the same level. It's still a live issue, and what this bill that we are bringing for your consideration today seeks to do is strengthen protections to prevent pay discrimination and also crucially clarify rules. Because as you'll hear from one of our employer presenters, knowing what the rules are is actually a really important step in helping both employers and employees avoid running afoul of pay, equal pay, fair pay laws. So final thing I would note is that there are a couple of amendments not before you today, but that we intend to bring to you that would include disability status as one of the protected class statuses regarding which pay discrimination and these protections apply. The protections in this bill apply. Already there are protections against discriminating against people with disabilities. And then also actual or perceived gender identity. That is currently contained within sexual orientation by law, but because one of the things that we value is calling out the dignity and entitlement to fairness of all people, we think it would be appropriate to consider specifically naming actual or perceived gender identity as bases for protection under this bill. And with that, I'm honored to turn over the mic to my colleague and Majority Leader, Representative Williamson.
Good afternoon, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Jennifer Williamson. I'm the state representative for House District 36. And today I'm testifying on this bill on behalf of an inspiring Oregonian who cannot be here in person today. Becky Sauerbrunn is the co-captain of the U.S. national women's soccer team. She's an Olympic gold medalist, a women's World Cup champion, captain of the FC Kansas City, and I'm proud to say she's my constituent. One of the best defensive players in the world, she's represented the United States at two FIFA Women's World Cup and two Summer Olympics. Becky has won two National Women's Soccer League championships and was awarded Defender of the Year for three consecutive seasons. She's been honored by President Obama at the White House, was part of the first women's sports team to be honored with a ticker tape parade and a key to the city of New York, and was among the first women players ever to be featured in a popular FIFA video game series. On top of all of these and other incredible achievements, Becky is an outspoken advocate for pay equity. She and four of her fellow national team members have been fighting in court against the brazen discrimination by the U.S. soccer, both in the area of compensation and in treatment. Despite her obligations in this ongoing dispute, work with the U.S. national team, her regional team, Becky took the time to write a letter to this committee. She couldn't be here today because practice started last week, so she had to go. Dear Chair Holvey, I write to voice my strong support for House Bill 2005, which works to promote equal pay for equal work. This particular issue hits close to home for me as a player for the United States women's national soccer team. For the past several years, we've been engaged in a fight to ensure the kind of pay equity this bill would provide. In spite of our collective success as a team, including a World Cup win, a number one FIFA ranking, and the profit we earn for U.S. soccer and the comparable work obligations, male players are compensated in a very different way and much more significantly. This is an issue not just about money either. It's about basic treatment of players compared to our male counterparts. From the type of field we play on to the way we travel, there are big differences between the genders in spite of our shared employer and our shared profession. Nationally, this type of gender discrimination we face is unfortunately normal. On the average, a woman is paid 79 cents for every dollar a man makes. When it comes to women of color, the inequity is even larger, and factors like education still do not level the playing field. While our fight for future generations of female soccer players go on, you have an opportunity in Oregon to ensure that working women do not face the type of inequity we do. Thank you for your consideration of this bill and for your work to ensure equal pay for equal work. Sincerely, Becky Sauerbrunn. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good afternoon, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Janelle Bynum, and I represent House District 51. I'm a proud co-sponsor of House Bill 2005. I am trained as an electrical engineer, practiced at General Motors. I'm a franchisee, and I'm also the mother of two daughters and two sons. In my home, we teach our daughters that their work isn't worth any less than their brother's work, but I worry that this message will ring hollow when they enter the workforce to begin their careers. And so, as we heard a little bit before, the numbers really do speak for themselves. American women who work full-time year-round earn only 79 cents for every dollar that a man makes. For communities of color, the median hourly wage for African American and Latino men was $15 and $14, respectively, compared to $21 for white American men. For women, African American women and Latino women, they earn $13 an hour and $12 an hour, compared to their white counterparts at $17. So the income gap persists as well for those with a college degree. African American and Latino men and white women with a college degree earn only 80% of what college-educated white men make. So we need to address this issue. Our daughters need us to address this issue, and I'm here today in support of House Bill 2005. Thank you, Chair Holvey, and members of the committee.
Rep Lively, do you want to come over here?
Chair Hovey, vice chairs, members of the committee, my name is John Lively. I'm state representative from House District 12, which encompasses most of the great city of Springfield. I'm honored to be here with Representative Williamson, Representative Bynum, and Representative Leininger to support this bill. This is quite an interesting lineup when I sit here. You notice my hair is a little different color than some of those. For most of my working career, I've had the honor to be a manager where I worked, and I've managed companies from 5 employees to 600 employees. And so when I come at this, first I think about what my experience has been, and I've had the privilege of working in companies where this was never an issue. We had described jobs, we had salary ranges, and everything that was in place, even if I had 5 employees, and we always hired the people based on the person's qualifications and they met the standards, never once questioned what they made before or if there's anything that's involved with it. And so for me personally, I've worked in positions, but I understand, even in all those years, and it's been over 45 years, that there was a lot of other companies and opportunities that were not the same. So that's part of what brings me to supporting this bill. One of the things that happened in my life, so I have two beautiful daughters who today are very successful. But as they were growing up and going into the workforce, they faced some challenges, just like many of them do today. My youngest daughter was training in a company to be a manager, and had been there quite a while, and was a vice manager, and was ready for a promotion to be a manager of this particular operation. She met all the qualifications. She was senior from a standpoint of the time that she'd been in the position, and they had indicated to her that she would be the next person up. When it came to the position, my daughter was not promoted. She didn't get the raise or promoted. And it was indicated she did not get it because she was a young female about to be married and was of childbearing age. That disturbed me and my daughter significantly. And while there was a lot we could have done at that point to try to pursue the thing, it was clear in that day and age in the company that she was dealing with that it was going to be a long struggle. And she got on with her life, and thank goodness she's in employment today where that's not a factor, but that certainly happened. And that at that point really opened my eyes to what was going on. Recently, I had a conversation with a good friend of mine who's a manager in the tech industry. And we were talking about this particular issue on the struggles that he faces with getting employees or not getting employees in the tech industry. And when I talked about one of the provisions that had to do with being able to ask about previous salary, what he indicated to me is if he wasn't able to ask about what the previous salary was, he would have no real way to determine what they should pay that person, i.e., could I pay him less than what the position requires? Because they happen to be making less. So that kind of was startling for me. Last week, I think it was Thursday, potentially, Celeste Edmond, who's CEO of Lunar Logic in Eugene, was in an interview on TV and KZI regarding pay equity issues. And I have a lot of respect for Celeste. She's very successful in the field. Technology is a very large growing segment down in Lane County, and there's over 5,000 employees. Celeste is one of only two female CEOs, though, in the industry, and she can tell from firsthand experience, even at her level, there's pay inequities. But what she talked about is what they do as a company is they do market research continually to keep their pay scales in that comparable. And what she said she finds in those each time is that the inequities, and especially with female workers, is 20% in many cases lower than what it is for comparable male in those fields. And so from the standpoint of doing the search, and if it's African-American women or women of other ethnicities, in many cases that spread is more. The good news from her standpoint is she lives in the state of Oregon, has a business in the state of Oregon, and views us as a progressive state. And so she has encouragement that we'll take actions and steps in order to keep moving towards closing that pay gap. So based on those reasons, I'm here to ask your support of House Bill 2005. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate you coming off and kicking us off with this, with your testimony. It's, I think, helpful to get going. And we'll get to some of the experts. Nobody's dying to ask you a question, it doesn't look like. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So up next, I'd like to have Andrea Peluso, Whitney Stark, and Lori Cremona Wagner.
Hello, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Andrea Peluso. I'm the Executive Director of Family Forward Oregon. As we've heard so far in the testimony given, equal pay for equal work is still a far-off reality for most women. It takes many forms, but it can be seen across industries and at all ages in all types of work. You've heard the statistics. The most recent statistic actually shows that Oregon's slightly closing our gap. This year, Oregon women are making 80 cents on the dollar for every dollar that men earn. And African-American women and Latinas are earning much less, as we heard. We know this has dire consequences as increasingly families are reliant on women's income to get by. Mothers in particular are also impacted by the gap. We see that mothers are experiencing greater wage gaps, sometimes as much as a 40% wage gap for equal work. And a greater gap as compared to what fathers earn. And we're seeing an increasing number, as I noted, of families that are reliant on women as either the co- or sole breadwinners for their families, which has economy-wide consequences. So we see this House Bill 2005 as an important step to ending pay inequality in Oregon. It includes two important provisions that we think will help to ensure that all protected classes are paid equally for equal work. First, it precludes employers from screening job applicants based on salary history or to base a salary decision on one's previous salary history. We think this will help break the cycle of pay disparity that can often trap women in wages lower than their counterparts over multiple jobs and wage gaps that compound over the course of their career. The second component of House Bill 2005 is arguably for me, the most important provision of the bill, which requires that employees are paid equally for work of comparable character. Current law in Oregon is not adequate to protect workers from pay discrimination, and I think we'll hear more about that. While we do have basic anti-discrimination provisions in civil rights law, these protections don't include the standard that workers be paid equally for work of comparable character, simply that they not be discriminated against on the basis of their protected class status. Likewise, the current pay inequity statute in wage and hour law doesn't refer to all of our protected classes, just pay equity between the sexes. And neither civil rights nor wage and hour law set a standard for what work of a comparable character means, which this law, this bill does. We see House Bill 2005 as a critical part of ending pay disparity, and we know that there's not one policy that will solve this gap, but we think this is an important step, along with things like paid family and medical leave and making childcare more affordable, to ensuring that women have both the support they need in and around the workplace to be successful. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Whitney Stark. I'm an attorney. I practice in employment and labor law, and I have reviewed the House Bill 2005 and find that it provides essential and necessary additional protections for employees. Importantly, though, it also clarifies several key issues that improve both an employer's ability to comply with the law as well as an employee's ability to enforce it. So the bill expands its protection beyond gender to include additional protected classes. And that protection is significant for each of the protected classes, but it also should make the law easier to administer. An employer can implement changes across the board and not just based on gender, and that should make that easier for all parties involved in these kinds of disputes to understand what their obligations are. And significantly, the bill would continue to require equal pay for comparable work, but with the proposed changes, it would affirmatively prohibit employers from setting compensation based on an employee's past compensation or relying on that compensation to set salary. I recently had an employee contact me who faced pay disparity in their work, and these changes would be incredibly helpful to them. This employee, she's a female. She works in a very male-dominated field. She works in a company with very few other females, and she was frequently the only female at the table. She was a single mom. She started in an entry-level position, and she worked her way up to a more senior-level position. Once she reached that more senior position, she learned that during her tenure, moving up in the company in earlier positions, there were several men who had held identical jobs that she had with the same title who had been paid significantly more than she did. And that is extremely upsetting and concerning for several reasons, but it also illustrates why this bill is so important. Without this bill, she's left with very few choices. But with this bill, she would have the opportunity to apply for new jobs within her industry, and her historically lower paid salary would not be able to be used as a justification for continuing to pay her lower if she changes jobs. So the bill's protections would prevent that from happening in the future and break that cycle for her. Turning back to the language of the bill, it also makes several critical clarifications. First, it adds to the definition of compensation to make it clear that compensation includes all types of income and benefits that are paid to employees. So that includes wages, it includes bonuses and fringe benefits. It adds to the definition of work of comparable character, so that provides more certainty as to what type of work has to be paid equally. Making the law more specific in that way ensures that employers know exactly what steps they have to take to be in compliance, rather than having to guess at compliance when the language is vague or fuzzy. So, for example, with the bill, an employer will know that if it pays wages based on a system that measures quantity of production, like in piece rate work, they will know that they're in compliance. It provides that additional level of certainty. Additionally, the proposed amendments explain that protected leaves of absences cannot be counted against an employee in their seniority. And that is an important issue that could potentially be confusing for both an employee and an employer. And finally, the bill includes several key enforcement provisions. It expands the time period in which an employee has to notify a public body, so this is a public employee, from 6 months to 1 year. And it expands the remedies. For example, it allows an injured employee the right to seek a jury trial or compensatory damages. Those are very valuable rights to an injured employee. In summary, the proposed amendments
provide important clarifications, add affirmative obligations that strengthen the likelihood of achieving equal pay for protected classes, and add remedies for an employee harmed by discrimination in pay.
Chair Holvey and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lori Cremona-Wagner, and I'm very pleased to have an opportunity to testify in favor of House Bill 2005. Let me tell you a little bit about who I am and my business experience and why I believe this legislation is common sense to maintain Oregon's reputation as a positive environment for business. I went to Stanford University. I have my bachelor's degree in architecture, my master's degree in civil engineering. I spent 20 years working in senior leadership positions in high-tech companies from Silicon Valley to Texas to now Germany as a leader in marketing, process improvement, and the owner of a $10 million P&L, with our top goal being to drive margin for the business. As a corporate executive, there's no one that leads a tighter ship than me when it comes to wages, efficiency, and managing the bottom line. I now manage the Business Insights and Performance Management team at SAP, and I'm in charge of increasing efficiency and effectiveness for 2,000 marketeers and a $1 billion global marketing budget. I live in Lake Oswego with my husband and my four children. And what I want to do is tell you a story about what I've experienced to explain why I think this legislation is so important and also why I think it is so reasonable to implement. Not at my current company, which I just joined this year, because it has such explicit values around diversity and inclusion, but still very recently. We have an annual corporate-wide compensation review. Most companies do this. I've been doing this for about 20 years. And I just faced this issue head on. As a leader of a business, one of my direct reports was the head of sales, and he happened to have two leaders in the Americas. One was male and one was female. And he came to me with his recommendation around how to allocate the budget for the merit increases. It was presented in terms of almost all of the allocation for the merit increase going to the man and a very small amount going to the woman, when in fact the woman had been my top performer for the last year, and she also was being paid 20% less than the man already. So I questioned him and I said, why are you giving the merit increase allocation to the man? And he said to me, straight to me, without hesitating, well, he's the sole wage earner for his family. His wife doesn't work, and he needs this. The woman's was part of a dual income household. She didn't really need to be working. This allocation should go to the man. And I right away straightened him out, said in no way was gender bias going to be a factor in how we were allocating this budget. But it really highlighted to me the fact that this was so prevalent, that he would actually be okay even telling me this, not only having this mindset, but sharing this out loud. And I also wanted to tell you this story because I wanted to let you know that we have an annual compensation review in place and a merit increase allocation budget. This is part of something that the last four companies that I've worked for has had in place. We have a system, as almost every company does, no matter how small the company, has an HR system that shows you the relative pay of each worker relative to the median compensation of that level. It's really easy to objectively understand where there are issues. And we also have the budget available to us every year as part of even just a 4% increase overall to the business to make the changes to set things right. So I really wanted to make sure that that you knew that I thought this was not only prevalent today, but something that we really can change, that wouldn't be hard for companies to change if they knew the rules. So earlier we were talking about how important it is to clarify what the rules are. When the companies know what the rules are, we can follow the law. The clarity is really, really helpful. So you might hear the systems make this too hard and they're just a burden to companies and that this doesn't happen anymore, but I'm here to tell you this does happen. It's not hard. And in fact, it makes companies way more competitive because they can attract and keep top talent. And I think that's important to all Oregon companies today. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. Do we have questions? Representative Doherty.
Well, actually, I just have one comment because I wasn't going to mention this until you talked about the thing that sold Breadwinner and so on. My mother taught in Eastern Washington before World War II and made less than the male teacher that was in her elementary school. And when she asked the principal, he said, because he has a because he's a man, there's a family to raise. The only problem is that he was single. Mm-hmm. So whether it's 1941 or whether it's 2017, I guess things haven't really changed.
Exactly.
Representative Barreto.
Yeah, I had the part here on the second page where you're screening an employer. Actually, you're screening job applicants based on current and past compensation. And we have done this when we've hired people from other companies that either come to us or we go to them and say, hey, we'd like to hire you. You're doing a great job over there. Basically, what do we have to pay you? How much you make? And, you know, what are your benefits? What are everything else? Because one, they're not going to come to work for you for less money unless they just really like your company. Two, you want to kind of know where you're at if you can even afford them. And so what do you do with that part of this bill?
I'm so glad you brought that up because I thought that was actually one of the strongest parts of this bill. So when I think when, you know, if you take a negotiation class in business school, any negotiation class, especially when it comes to negotiating compensation, says the most important thing to do is to wait as long as you possibly can until after you've been offered the role to tell them what your current compensation is. And the reason that's so important is because a job can actually be re-leveled based on the compensation. So, I mean, I can tell you about my current experience, but if a job has already been leveled and you've deemed someone worthy of that role, then you should be paying them within that wage span and not re-leveling the position down to take into account their current comp. Go ahead.
Yeah, follow up. She's
follow
supposed
up.
To tell me that. He's supposed
yeah,
to tell me
yeah. Protocols, you know.
Yeah, now this was a position we hadn't had before. So it was a new position that we were thinking of putting in as national sales manager, and we didn't have one. And this fellow came to me and said, you know, I'd like to be your national sales manager. I said, well, we don't have one. You know, what are we talking about? So, you know, that's where it comes down to, look, we didn't have this position. It wasn't, didn't have a clue what these folks make, you know, so there was this dialogue.
Can I suggest too that I think that kind of a dialogue may continue through a salary negotiation process post this bill. The difference would just be that you couldn't require to know exactly what they were paid at their previous position in order to make a determination about the salary range. And that has the effect of institutionally keeping someone who's been paid less for the same work at a lesser rate going forward.
And may I also? So generally when we are approved to hire, we have to have an approved budget for that position so that we know what the impact on the overall margin is going to be. Mm-hmm. So if you had already determined a certain value for that role and that person meets the qualifications for that role, then generally that's where our starting point would be, especially because we would have determined what that level, what that role was worth and what the band should be beforehand. So I think it's reasonable to be able to negotiate the salary without having confirmation of what the person's salary would have been before.
Yeah, follow up just for a second.
A follow up for just a second.
Yeah. It just seems to me like this doesn't need to be in law. You know, this should be between an employer and an employee. Mm-hmm. So that's all I have to say.
Well, can I reply to that? So,
go ahead.
So I'll tell you at my current, I've seen applications for a job where it actually says that the application won't be considered complete and accepted unless you state what your current salary is, and basically mandates that would have to be part of the process. And that's what I think is so important to eliminate from the process, is that requirement to provide your current compensation in order to apply for the job.
I'd like to say more, but I can't.
It was a long second. Representative Fahey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to confirm to the panel that there's nothing in this bill that would prevent an employer from asking a candidate what their preferred salary would be or what salary they require. It's just it can't ask you, they cannot ask you what your salary actually is. So that might get to a little bit of Representative Barreto's.
That's right.
That's right. And there are also, there's a couple other things in the bill that you are allowed, it doesn't prevent you from looking at market wages or having conversations about market wages or ranges, and you can always confirm after an offer is made what their previous salary was. So that's a very good point, and there's additional room, I think, as the bill is written to address your concern.
Other questions for this panel? I will note that, I became aware of this a while back, too, when I knew people that were, as an attorney, working in for nonprofits, doing that sort of work. And, very good attorney, but then when they go to the private work, they're asked about their past salary history. And, the nonprofit work was a lot of charity time in my mind. And so that was, really wasn't. I didn't think that was fair, recognizing the quality of the employees. So, just a note to that.
And going from part-time to full-time.
Oh, that would be another one where that would have an impact. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Any other questions for this panel? Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I appreciate your testimony today. Up next, we'll have Trish Garner, Zahir Jana Ahmad, close, and Alana Bertle Guinea. And Alana, would you like to go first? Probably supposed to be somewhere else about now.
I may run after I testify if there aren't any questions. I'm happy to stay if there are, though. Thank you, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ilana Pertl-Guinea. I'm here on behalf of Governor Brown as her labor and workforce policy advisor. The governor is sorry she can't be here today, but she's glad to see the legislature taking up this issue. Governor Brown has stated on numerous occasions before that she has actually had personal experience with pay inequity. And I would guess, frankly, that we probably all know somebody personally who has experienced pay inequity at some point in their career. Oregon has made progress on this issue. We are, in fact, ahead of the rest of the country. But the pay gap, even when adjusted for factors like type of work performed and education level, is persistent in our state, and it's consistent. In essence, it's stuck. For our state, for all Oregonians to be at our best and working at our highest capacity, we must close the pay gap. And it's going to take another big push to get it unstuck and to start to narrow that gap that we continue to see. This bill is a great place to start. It's a good way to have that conversation, and I hope that as you hear more testimony today, you'll learn more about the importance of this bill in moving forward to narrow that gap. Thank you on behalf of the governor for having this conversation, and we look forward to working with you on this topic.
Is there a question for Alana before? You're free to go if I had any control of it to start with.
Chair Holvey, Vice Chair Barreto, Vice Chair Bynum, and members of the committee, thank you for welcoming me today. My name is Zahir Jan Mohammed, and I'm the policy director at APANO, the Asian
and
Pacific.
And can you move away from the mic just a little, push it away from you? It's very sensitive. You can,
sure.
You know, this
is
far.
That okay? Yeah. Okay. My name is Zahir Jan Mohammed, and I'm the policy director at APANO, the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon. APANO is a statewide grassroots organizing and advocacy group that unites Asians and Pacific Islanders to work for social justice. It's a pleasure to speak on this topic. One thing I just wanted to add is that before I coming to APANO, I worked in the U.S. Congress. I worked as a journalist. I worked for Amnesty International for many years, and this is something that I've seen in every employer. I've seen it. I saw it in the U.S. Congress. I saw it at Amnesty International. I saw it everywhere. So it's a pleasure to speak on this issue. We're proud to endorse this bill, and I thank the representatives who drafted this legislation. Several of the speakers today spoke about the wage gap and how the wage gap is actually greater for women of color in particular, and I wanted to focus particularly on the Asian American community. I think oftentimes there's this assumption that Asian Americans don't face some of the same sort of challenges that other women of color face, and so I wanted to sort of cite some information from the National Women's Law Center about some of the discrepancies in which the gaps exist for women of color, particularly Asian women of color. So Asian American women typically lose about $365,000 to the wage gap. This means that Asian American women would have to work nearly 48 years to make what white non-Hispanic men make in 40 years. More telling, the wage gap is actually wider for older Asian American women. Again, according to the National Women's Law Center in their March 2016 report, among workers aged 45 to 64, the pay gap is 68 cents, and among those 65 and older, it is 53 cents, which means that the older Asian American women tend to fall behind at the very time in their life in which they need the additional resources to help save for their retirement. Now, one of the interesting things about this report is that it shows that the pay gap exists across all occupations. So Asian Americans have, compared to other groups of color, a higher rate of education per capita, but we see that this wage gap exists across all occupations. So, for example, Asian American women working as physicians and surgeons, and I come from a family of physicians, surgeries tend to be a male-dominated high-wage occupation. They make 54 cents for every dollar paid to their white, non-Hispanic male counterparts. Now, lower-skilled jobs, you see the wage gap getting even bigger. Lower-skilled jobs, for example, where women work as hand laborers or freight or stock or material movers, which tends to be male-dominated, and low-wage occupations, women make 76 cents for every dollar paid to their male counterparts. And this is something that has existed throughout. In 1988, the earliest year for which data exists on this, an Asian American woman working full-time made about 69 cents for every dollar. Today, it's 84 cents. So there has been an increase, but still that gap exists, just really over 15 cents a quarter of a century ago. So now there are multiple reasons why these pay gaps occur. Some of these are cultural reasons, such as the fact that women are often socialized into not negotiating for higher wages. My parents, for example, are Indian immigrants to the United States, and I know that when my mother found a job in the U.S. as a travel agent many years ago, she was so grateful for the chance to work that she did not realize until much later that she was paid less than her male counterparts with similar experience. So part of the challenge is to educate employees on their rights and how they can and should negotiate, something that we do at APANO. But part of the change has to happen at the legal level as well. Nicole Porter, a law professor at the University of Toledo, wrote a piece for the New York Times in 2016 in which she argued, quote, "Employers often rely on what I have called market excuses. One of those market excuses is that when employers rely on what an applicant was making in a prior job in order to set that applicant's pay. Because women have historically been paid less than men for reasons both lawful and unlawful, that pay disparity perpetuates itself when employers base current salary on prior salary." So I just wanted to close with a story. So I spoke to some colleagues and coalition partners, and Chair Olvi, you mentioned about the NGO work. So one of the stories that actually I heard in the NGO community is an example of how we had a great testimony from the private sector. It's actually from a coalition partner who was working at a restaurant during her graduate studies here in Portland. And when she tabulated her final salary, now when she was working at a restaurant, she wasn't getting paid for when she was taking care of her sick parents or when she was on maternity leave. leave, or, and so her salary at the end of the year was about $25,000 or so, which is still pretty good, but you know, certainly not a lot for sort of like in the, what you'd see like a full-time NGO person making. And so when she did apply and she was asked for her previous salary, and she asked for what colleagues of her skill level, her master's degree, were making, which was about $40,000, they said they couldn't justify giving her a $15,000 pay increase, even though that was the salary they had allocated. Because they said, well, this is what you're making, you should be happy with just $35,000. But again, a full-time staff is going to give paid time off, is going to give maternity leave, etc. So when I she wanted to testify today, unfortunately she couldn't, but when I told her about this legislation, she said, it's about time. So Apano, we're very excited to see this legislation, we're very excited to support it, and we're honored to, here to testify, and I thank you so much for giving me this opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Trish Garner, and I'm the State Public Policy Chair of American Association of University Women of Oregon. As we meet here today, it really may very well be that some people do not believe that there is a gender wage gap. Let me put that notion to rest. The data that gender pay gap exists is clear and convincing. Reports show that women working full-time on average earn 80 cents for every dollar for a full-time male work. In Oregon, the median annual earnings ratio of women's earnings to men's is 81%. Over a lifetime of work, assuming approximately 47 years, the total estimated loss of earnings of women compared to men is $700,000 for a high school graduate, $1.2 million for a college graduate, and $2 million for a professional school graduate. Critics of fair pay legislation often charge that pay differences between men and women are simply a matter of personal choices. Again, this is not the case. It is an unverified and unhelpful assumption. If we focus, for example, on college graduates, just 1 year after college graduation, women were paid 82% of what their similarly educated and experienced male counterparts were paid. 10 years after graduation, that gap widened, and women were only paid 69% of what men were paid, despite the fact that women were more likely to obtain an advanced degree. After accounting for a litany of factors, and I'll list them, college major, occupation, economic sector, hours worked, months unemployed since graduation, grade point average, type of undergraduate institution, institution selectivity, age, geographical region, and marital status, there is still a 7% unexplained difference in the earnings of male and female college graduates only 1 year after graduation. At every level of academic achievement, women's median earnings are less than men's median earnings. And in some cases, the gender pay gap is actually larger at higher levels of education. The gender gap, of course, does not affect all women equally. Most women of color, older women, mothers, and women who have achieved higher levels of education experience an even larger gap. Compared with salary information for white male workers, African American women are paid 63% when compared to the pay for white men. Hispanic and Latina women experience the largest pay gap, taking home just 54% of what white men were paid for the very same job. Women's earnings throughout Oregon are not the same. For example, in 2014, in Northwest Oregon, and I include Clatsop, Columbia, and Tillamook counties, where I lived for a while, and so was interested in those statistics. But in those areas, in 2014, women's earnings were about half of men's statewide. There were 76% of all Oregon women's earnings and 64% of Northwest state men's earnings. So we can see that there are even more significant differences in different areas of our state. Statewide, average monthly earnings of women Oregonians are lower than half of men in virtually every industry. To pick a few, In the real estate rental and leasing business, the ratio of women's to men's earnings is 77%. Retail grade is 69%. Public administration, 76%. And this is interesting, professional, scientific, and technical services, 49%. Support for the gender wage gap is supported by the fact that women enter, when they enter a male-dominated field, the pay decreases. The figures I've just cited to you relate to full-time workers. If we include part-time workers, the women-to-men earning ratio would be 72.7%, obviously lower than the 81 I had just cited. Fair pay is not simply a woman's issue. It's a family issue. Between 1967 and 2012, the percentage of mothers who brought home at least a quarter of the family's earnings rose from less than a third, which is 28%, to nearly two-thirds, or 63%. Women who are mothers often encounter a motherhood penalty that extends beyond the actual time out of the workforce. Mothers who hold full-time year-round jobs are generally paid 71 cents for every dollar. Experimental research has documented that employers are less likely to hire mothers compared to childless women. And when employers do make an offer to a mother, they offer her a lower salary than they do other women. Fathers, in contrast, do not suffer a penalty compared with other men. The fathers actually receive a wage premium after having a child. Mothers who are women of color can also face what's called a sex plus bias, which places them even further behind. House Bill 2005 contains provisions regarding screening on the basis of prior salary history. Since we know pay discrimination starts early in women's careers, relying on prior salary as a marker for future pay only compounds the problem. In addition to exacerbating previous discrimination, reliance on salary history also harms individuals who've taken time away from the workforce. In recognition of the short-sightedness of relying on prior salary history to set wages, many employers are now seeing the value of basing wages on factors other than prior pay, because the net result is a more informed applicant pool. As markets set prices for goods and services, they should freely and fairly set wages. The gender gap is persistent and pernicious. It is only fair to remedy it. And I thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today, and I urge you to support House Bill 2005. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Questions for these two? I just have one question. I know that, you know, we've had laws on the books about discrimination for a while, but it doesn't seem from your statistics that it's made a difference.
I would concur.
And so this bill's attempting to make that difference by being more specific.
Chair Holvey and members of the committee, I totally agree. The clarification and emphasis is critical. Yes.
Thanks. No other questions for you, so thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Up next, Betsy Earls, Piper Sweeney, and Juanita Lint. Apologize if I don't get the names quite right.
I think you did great, right?
Yep.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Betsy Earls representing Associated Oregon Industries and Oregon Business Association. I'm going to go over some of our more technical concerns with the bill and then let Piper and Juanita talk about the impact that the bill would have on their businesses and their workplaces. AOI, OBA, and our 1,600 member employers unequivocally support the principles of equal pay for equal work. We support the federal and state laws that protect fair compensation. We believe that the best long-term strategy to achieve pay equity in the workplace is to ensure that all workers possess the education and skills that allow our enterprises to succeed in an increasingly complex global economy. I want to be very clear that our concerns about this specific bill do not have anything to do with any kind of opposition to pay equity or fair pay. We do, however, have several technical concerns about the bill, and I wanted to go over those with you briefly today. We can talk about them more in detail at some point if you would like to do. There were several examples of pay inequity given in prior testimony, and I think you've heard a lot of statistics. Several of them you probably already knew. And as you just pointed out yourself, Mr. Chair, under current law, any member of a protected class in Oregon today who alleges pay discrimination can get relief under 659A030, either in civil court or through Boley's Civil Rights Division. So this is not a situation where complainants are limited to an agency remedy. They also have a remedy in our civil courts right now under current law. I think one of the most concerning things for us about this bill, besides the increased penalties, is the fact that it shifts the burden of proving discrimination from the complainant, the person that's bringing the lawsuit, onto the employer to protect themselves. So employer liability for wage discrimination in Oregon generally requires the complainant to prove a discriminatory motivation under current law. The person that's bringing the lawsuit has to prove their case. But House Bill 2005 creates a kind of strict liability that requires really no showing of intent to discriminate on the part of the employer. An employee, in order to prevail, would only have to show two things. They'd have to show that he or she was performing work that was comparable to that of coworkers of different genders, races, or other protected characteristics, and that he or she was paid less than those other workers. Once the employee showed that, under House Bill 2005, the employer would then be basically liable for the difference in wages unless he or she could prove that the pay disparity was based on a factor other than one of those protected characteristics. And I think what's significant about that is just that the absence of discriminatory motivation wouldn't be a defense to a claim in the same way that it is under Oregon law right now. And that's a pretty big change. Furthermore, the employer's burden to prove that they were relying on factors other than the protected class status as a defense to that purported pay differential are so stringent under this bill that it would be nearly impossible for the employer to meet. The burden can only be met if the employer can demonstrate that the inequity, of course, is not based on or derived from the protected class, but also is not based on perceptions of traditional or gender-appropriate roles, which is an extremely vague description of an extremely high burden, that the differential is job-related to the position in question, is based on business necessity, and accounts for the entire compensation differential. So you have a kind of a difficult mix in that paragraph of extremely vague terms and extremely specific terms, all of which have to add up to the exact entire compensation differential. When you look at factors like these that have to be proven specifically, they eliminate other really good reasons that employers could have for a pay differential. And I'll just throw one out there right now, but that could be an employer that has several different locations for their business where employees are paid differently depending on the region of the country they're located or the region of the state they're located. That's not a factor that would go to prove anything about pay inequity under this bill. I'll just talk briefly about the pay history section that Representative Barreto brought up. The proffered reason for this part of the bill is to reduce gender-based disparities, but it goes quite a bit beyond that because it prohibits an employer from considering prior compensation for any employee or prospective employee, regardless of their prospective protected class status. Many employers ask prospective employees about their prior pay for legitimate reasons, and I think one of the most important ones that has been brought up to me is that when somebody's hiring somebody that they very much want to have work for them, they're not sure if the person is going to stay or is going to stick, and one of the things that they One of the factors that they use in their, you know, I mean, sort of cogitation or analysis about whether it's going to work out is what the person made at their prior job. If the person is coming to work for them for a substantially lower rate of pay, you know, I think there are questions that an employer legitimately might want to ask about why this job is so attractive to that person when they're considering whether it's going to be a good fit. The last thing I wanted to talk to you about is the statute of limitations in Section 3, Sub 5 of the bill. The bill states that it's an unlawful compensation practice that occurs every single time an employee is paid pursuant to a discriminatory decision or practice. So that means that there's a separate unlawful employment practice happening every time somebody gets a paycheck. That is pretty tough for an employer that is trying to defend a claim like this, especially with some of the concerns that we have outlined above, just because it could end up, the employer could end up in a situation where there are liabilities going back significantly into the past that they weren't aware of or hadn't anticipated having to defend or remedy. So again, I know this sounds like a lot of bad stuff coming from the business community once again, and I want to be really clear that that is not where we mean to go with the issue of pay equity. I think there are some places that we could work together on the issue. I don't believe that this bill provides significantly new protections for protected classes, but it does provide some traps for the unwary, honestly, and significant new liabilities. So that's what we're concerned about. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Chair Holvey and committee, my name is Piper Sweeney, and I appreciate the ability to come and talk a little bit about my concerns on House Bill 2005. First of all, I would agree there's no part of pay equity that I am not for. This is, you know, critical. And, yeah, I think that the statistics are disturbing, and I think that it is something we do need to work to fix. But what I'm concerned about, at least for on our farm, that the appearance of inequity is not necessarily inequity. For example, I have two employees that do essentially the same jobs. I have Jorge, who is very, very conscientious. He's the guy to look around for something else to do while he's waiting for someone to pick him up if you're moving irrigation pipe. He's the guy that goes, you know, above and beyond. And he works with another one of our employees, Hank, who is a great guy. He does a good job. The difference in productivity, though, is measurable. So in this case, because Hank isn't in a protected class, I'm not going to, you know, have to deal with that if this should pass. I wouldn't have to deal with any repercussions. However, if the situation were exactly reversed and it was Jorge that didn't put as much effort in and get as much done as Hank, then Jorge could look at that and say, well, I think there's pay inequity here. And then I'm in a position of having to defend myself. Now, granted, I think it would hold up. I don't think that I would lose, but I have to defend myself then at that point, and I have to be able to prove, and in some cases prove, what's the thinking process, especially if they questioned, well, I don't think I put out less effort or whatever. So that's, you know, one concern. And then there was one other example I wanted to share with you is we have, we grow marionberries. So marionberries are picked at night. It's a pretty difficult job. You know, you just change your whole, your schedule for a month, where you work all night and sleep all day. It's pretty difficult. Well, we have had, both, young men and young women do this position, including my own kids. And at one point, my daughter asked me, why don't we have any women drivers on the berry pickers? And my husband said, that's funny. We used to, almost all the drivers for years and years were always, seemed to be the women that were driving. But we were kind of talking about that, and we thought, well, yeah, you know, are we being fair, and is there some reason for this? Well, as we look back, the reason was we had had young women that would work, and maybe they'd work this summer, and they'd take a couple of summers off, and then they come back in college, and they wanted to earn money, so they'd work again, where I had mostly the young men who were consistently, you know, working. So if they came back three times versus three summers in a row, when you only work one time of year, you know, you lose that experience in remembering how everything works and how does that machine work? How do you need to set it? How do you need to, you know, do those different things? And so for about a 10-year period, we'd had almost all males driving. So that, again, could be, you look at that and say, well, for, yeah, I'm looking back 10 years, you guys haven't had women drivers. What's the deal? When actually that wasn't a consideration in any way, shape, or form. And so it's the liability for our farm that I'm concerned with. And there are so many things that I feel that I could defend and win in a court situation, but I can't afford to go to court. And so I feel this opens us up, and it makes me really nervous. I, you know, would like to see this to where it's a little more provable for the employer. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Hi, Chair Holby and members of the committee. I'm Juanita Lint, and I'm the owner with my husband of Plum Hill Vineyards out in Gaston, Oregon. I have a degree in computer science engineering, rare for anyone in my generation, but particularly for a woman. I was the only woman in my class after the first semester at OIT. My professional career included 22 years of large-scale project management in highly technical fields, utilizing my master's degree in technology management. During that career, I managed several large teams and projects as large as $30 million. For the majority of my career, I was paid more than my male colleagues. In fact, I was paid the most at my level in my department, sometimes more than my boss. In 2000, I took an early retirement and started up a retail craft bazaar business and began my winery career by assisting other wineries. In 2007, my husband and I created a boutique vineyard and winery, Plum Hill Vineyards, including grape production, wine processing, marketing, and agritourism. I'm here today to testify in opposition to House Bill 2005, which would make it unlawful employment practice to screen job applicants based on salary history, to base salary decisions on salary history, and to seek salary history information from a job applicant until after making a job offer. This policy would lump these standard job screening procedures into categories of wage-related offenses that include rights to a jury trial, the result of which would result compensatory and punitive damages. In my professional career, before becoming a small business owner myself, I was able to negotiate a higher salary for myself during the interview process on multiple occasions, and I suspect even higher than some of the men. I'm concerned that this bill would discourage women from asking for a higher salary and prohibit employers from offering a higher salary to applicants for fear of being sued by current, former, or other prospective employees. In fact, I most likely would not have been offered what I required to get those positions. As an employer, I'm concerned that I would be forced to enact strict and rigid salary policies with no room for flexibility, and that in some circumstances, I would not be able to adequately match the right person with the right job. Currently, our top two employees are women, one of whom reports to my husband. Aside from the fact that every time the legislature acts to make lawsuits against employers more prevalent, it creates a chilling effect on small business creation, I'm here to share with you my personal views as a woman who worked over two decades in a field made up by a majority of men, and as a woman who now owns a business and is responsible for finding the right people to fill the positions that our business needs to run smoothly. HP 2005 would prohibit screening job applicants based on current or past compensation, determining compensation for a position based on current or past compensation of a prospective employee or current employee, and seeking the salary history of an applicant or employee from a current or former employee, unless the employer has already made a job offer that includes compensation. I'm not aware of any business that thinks discriminating against a woman is okay, and this bill has little to prevent the discrimination examples that have been discussed today. I want to point out that women are business owners too, not just employee, and this bill is just as likely to put a woman-owned business on the defensive as a business owned by a man. Again, on behalf of the thousands of small business owners in Oregon who are already following the law, especially small businesses owned by women, I ask you to oppose HB 2005. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Fahey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for Ms. Earls about your comments on the proposed prohibition on asking for salary history. So I think Rep. Barreto brought up a great point about, you know, sometimes employers don't actually know what to offer people, and you brought up a good point as well about we need to be able to make an offer that will retain someone, and we don't want to offer them less money. So right now, because of those reasons, some companies ask for salary history as a way to inform their decision-making process. So my question is, since this bill doesn't prohibit asking a candidate what they want to make, what their requirements or preference are for salary, why does that approach not address your concern? Is there something, do you have a concern about asking for salary preference versus salary history? Is there something that concerns you there?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Fahey. We do, and it's just because I've been through this situation myself when I've been hiring, where somebody wants the job for whatever reason. And, you know, maybe it is a good fit and maybe their judgment about what it's going to turn out to be is right. But when we ask what their salary preference is, you know, if they know kind of what the range is, they may tend, in fact, this has happened, they have tended to shoot kind of low. And then we have come to find out later on that actually what they made in the past was quite a bit more. And it turned out to be more of an issue than we had expected or hoped. And I think if we had known in the beginning, it would have helped us probably determine what the real motivations were around, or we would have been able to inquire further. It would have given us like one more trail to go down to inquire further about, you know, what she wanted out of the job and why she wanted to work with us.
Other questions? Mr. Bynum?
I just wanted to say thank you to the panel and thank you to Representative Leininger for bringing out so many positive, talented business owners, women who have really achieved something in their careers, and we've started a conversation about what's best for our state and what's best for our future. So just wanted to say thank you to the panel of talented business owners. And so thank you. Good job, guys.
Thank you, and I also appreciate your testimony and hope, you know, we will have a dialogue with about your concerns, and hopefully you can, you know, as share those with Rep. Leininger, the sponsor of the bill, and you know, try to include our committee analyst in, you know, the outcomes of those conversations.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I did have one more question. Why do you pick Marion Berry's at night?
Yeah.
Well, two reasons. They during the day they're warmer, so they're a little more mushy and tend to mush in there. But also they don't want to let go. They don't want to drop off the vine when they're warm. So got to make it as cool as you can.
I've been doing something wrong for years.
To go out at midnight and pick those.
I baby that plant, and it's just, wow. Okay, moving on. Next up, Nikki Fisher, Claire Berger, and Jessica Giannettino.
Do you want all three of us
in here? Yes. And again, I apologize if I don't get the names exactly right. So whoever would like to go first, go ahead.
Chair Holvey, Vice Chair Barreto, Vice Chair Bynum, members of the committee. My name is Nikki Fisher, and I'm a commissioner for the Oregon Commission for Women. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony in support of House Bill 2005. The Oregon Commission for Women is a strong supporter of House Bill 2005, as it believes equal pay for equal work is essential here in Oregon. We know how critical equal pay legislation is to Oregon and to Oregon families. We know the effect of this legislation will have impacts across age, location, disability status, income, religious affiliation, sexuality, gender identity, citizenship status, and primary language. Pay disparities among African American women is 63 cents to every dollar a white man makes. For Latino Oregonians, it's only 54 cents. These striking disparities have critical impacts on Oregon communities of color. The most recent report by the Oregon Women's Foundation, Count Her In, highlights how critical the need for pay equity legislation will be. The report highlights the most urgent issues impacting women in the state of Oregon, with pay equity as the number one most critical issue facing Oregon families. The wage gap hurts women and their families with each paycheck and results in lower retirement savings and less wealth to pass on to the next generation. Count Her In reports that women tend to be in jobs with unpredicted and irregular scheduling, which leaves them in chronic, part-time, low-paying jobs. The gender and race wealth gap in Oregon is created and perpetuated by discrimination, wage gaps, barriers to workforce participation, a lack of equitable opportunities, disproportionate criminal justice involvement, and unaffordable caregiving. This proposed legislation takes critical steps to ensure the pay fairness many women need by precluding employers from asking about previous salary history. We know this legislation is one step in course correcting decades of women making less than their male counterparts, and we are in full support of the legislation aimed at addressing systemic failures within the existing system. The Oregon Commission for Women, working towards equity for women and children, applauds the champions of this legislation for introducing fair and equitable practices that will make a solid impact in Oregon. We commissioners believe that it is an urgent matter and support systemic practices to close the pay gap for all working Oregonians. This legislation will work towards ensuring fair pay to all. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Chair Holvey, Vice Chair Bynum, and Vice Chair Barreto, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Claire Berger. I live at 2789 Heather Way in Forest Grove. I'm a lifelong resident of Oregon and have lived mostly in Western Washington County. I'd like to take this time to share an experience of fair pay with you. It's a little different than some of the other ones. I was offered a job with a large employer and was assured that my pay would be commensurate with my background and experience. The new position was one of a significant responsibility, demanding a high level, high set of skills, and a lot of domestic travel. When I accepted the position, I was told that the company would pay only 15% higher than my last position was paying. I was asked to have my last employer also send a letter to them verifying that that was my salary. A friend of mine had a much worse time. She had a master's degree. She was going for a position like mine that was of high skill level and a lot of travel. She had served in the Peace Corps the previous year before and had gotten a small stipend for that type of work. She was given 15% above what she got as a stipend, which was barely above minimum wage. This type of practice keeps women at a lower rate because they often enter into a new job from a position that is lower paid, limiting their ability to bargain for higher pay. This often carries into subsequent jobs as women move into future positions. Long term, and I know this because I am a retiree, the practice negatively impacts a woman's standard of living in retirement due to the lower rate of pay in years leading up to retirement. And many, many women are living in poverty who are in retirement, who have retired right now. So, yes, I do urge you to look at this very closely. It makes me very angry that we're still talking about this, and it's about time that there is something done to make it work.
Thank you.
Chair Holvey, Vice Chair Bynum, Vice Chair Barreto. My name is Jessica Genatino, and I'm testifying today on behalf of the Oregon AFL-CIO. The Oregon AFL-CIO represents 300,000 working Oregonians and considers ourselves the voice for all workers in the legislative process. We're proud to support House Bill 2005. For far too long, active participants in our workforce have been categorically denied equal access to wages, solely because of their gender and race, among other factors. In a world where almost 40% of women are breadwinners of their families, this is not sustainable, and it has incalculable negative impacts not only on individuals, but their families and our economy as a whole. When we look at what these disparities mean for Oregon workers, the following is true. Black women in Oregon make 70.2 cents per dollar that every white man in Oregon does. Native American women in Oregon make 61.6 cents per every dollar that every white man in Oregon does. And Latinas have the largest disparity at only 51 cents per dollar compared to a white man in the state of Oregon. And I drug you through those statistics because they're Oregon-specific and they're from 2015, and those women face those disparities under the current protections that we have. Over the course of their lifetimes, this equates to losses of over $500,000 for the average woman worker, and even greater losses for college-educated women of nearly $800,000. While collective bargaining agreements and representation in the workplace help mitigate these impacts, this is still a systemic problem that union members face. We recognize House Bill 2005 as a step in the right direction to right just one of the barriers that women, and in particularly women of color, face in the workforce. And we remain committed to ensuring equity for all workers. Thank you for the opportunity to testify and support today.
Thank you. Questions, Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think when you start throwing out statistics like that, I think you could also throw out statistics that say how many in this class graduated from high school, how many of this class grew up in a single-family dwelling, how many of this class were deprived in this other area. You know, and I don't mean to get into that, except that when you throw out some of those numbers, there's a lot of different criteria that make up where they end up when they're out in the workforce.
Chair Holvey, Representative, thanks for that. I think that when we look at these numbers, we know that folks face all kinds of barriers, but their ability to earn shouldn't be.
Yeah, if I could add, can I add?
Follow up?
Yeah, and it kind of goes to Mrs. Sweeney's point in the last panel, you know, where she said, you know, this person is different than this person. Yet this person, if it was switched around, this person was a special class or protected class, and they didn't put out. And this one over here was just the opposite. It makes a difference, and it does open up the door to litigation, which I think in anti-discrimination laws, I think in a state we do have to watch that, because pretty soon we become a state where it's not too friendly to do business.
Representative Hack.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. Thank you for coming today, and to all the women. We do have an issue. I don't think that there's many women out there that would say that at one point in their lives they haven't experienced this. But I think, you know, looking back also, there are many women that have blazed the trail before us and had a responsibility to us to be careful in how they did that. I think we, too, have a responsibility to those who are going to come after us. So I would just say I would hope that we would, while being brave and treading those waters, I also think it's important that we work hard to be careful not to alienate those who we have an opportunity to come alongside, which is business. I'd much rather see us be empowered together so that we can move forward and blaze the trail for younger women yet to come. I'm hoping that Representative Leininger can work together with some of our business folks that came up here and come together with something great that can empower women and can bridge the gap so that we can leave a legacy for younger generations to not have to go through some of the things that some of us have. So I just hope that we can come to some sort of an agreement and move something forward. Thank you.
Representative Evans.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I just want to say two things. One is I'm a white guy who's on these numbers that you talked about.
Really?
But I want to channel my mom's experience, who started working full-time at age 13. Her mom couldn't get medical care because in the 1940s, being a single mom because of a soldier who left her on her own, wasn't so cool, had to sit in the back of the church. My mom worked her way through to try to get degrees and never was able to catch up. So I, on her behalf anyway, I applaud what you're doing. My second comment, though, is as a professional, I spent most of my adult life in and out of the military. And the military has its major problems in lots of ways. But one thing the military gets right, and I would hope that business and nonprofits and the public and private sector look to it, when you're enlisted E1 or E2, it doesn't matter if you're male, female, whatever. If you're an O1, O2, it doesn't matter. If you are a pilot, there's money for being a pilot. If you're a submariner, there's money for being a submariner. I have commanded women in conflicts. I have been commanded by women in conflicts. And my point on that is that the military pay scale is transparent. And because of that transparency, everybody knows the rules. And again, I wouldn't necessarily wish the military on anybody, but in this particular case, I do think there's a lesson to be learned for consistency, certainty, and transparency. So I just want to say I applaud the effort.
Thank you. Really appreciate your testimony this afternoon. Bob Jundip.
Chair Holdy, members of the committee, my name is Bob Jundef. I'm the Executive Director of Disability Rights Oregon. Thank you very much for allowing me to testify today on House Bill 205. I'm really here because we reviewed the bill and we noticed that one of the protected groups in the originally drafted bill was not individuals with disabilities. And since you were addressing the question of wage disparity, I thought it was important to bring to your attention that wage disparity, among other types of employment discrimination, are a longstanding, serious problem for the disability community. My organization, Disability Rights Oregon, is primarily funded through federal grants, and about 25% of the funding that we receive addresses the great difficulties that people with disabilities have in working and returning to work. We provide benefits planning services to people who are receiving Social Security, who are trying to go back to work but are having trouble doing that because it can affect their benefits as well as their housing and other supports, health care. We help people with who experience discrimination in the workplace. We help people who have problems in getting job training and placement. So this is an area we know well, and the whole reason that we've been supported to do this work is because of the significant difficulty that people with disabilities who are ready and willing and able to work, the difficulty they have in obtaining work. As a general matter, the unemployment rate for people who are ready, willing, and able to work and have a disability is about twice that of people without disabilities. And according to the American Institute for Research, the pay disparity for people with disabilities is just a tick higher than it is for women in the workplace. The latest statistics I've seen are 37% wage disparity for this group. And so when I saw that there was a bill on this topic, I thought I would bring to your attention that there is another minority population that experiences problems in receiving equal pay for equal work, and that we would urge you to add people with disabilities into the bill through an amendment process once in order to address that concern.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Questions? Thank you so much for coming out and getting that on the record. And I got a note, Whitney Stark wanted to come back up for a second time.
Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to come back up. I'd like to just address some of the testimony that was given by some of the people who had concerns about the bill. make sure that everyone understands the what the bill does and doesn't do. I think it's important that the record is very clear. So first of all, there was a couple of concerns about whether or not you could pay people differently, for example, based on location. And the law does allow for that. An employer is permitted to pay wages that take into account a differential based on a bona fide factor other than a protected category, as long as it's not based. There's specific provisions that you need to consider when you're taking into account what that bona fide factor is. For example, you can't base it on a traditional perception of gender, but location would certainly qualify as a bona fide factor. So, for example, if you know that the cost of living is 10% more in Portland than in Medford, you could pay 10% more. So that shouldn't be a concern about the bill. Similarly, I believe I had some concerns about differences in workers or the merit, essentially, of a worker. And the bill expressly allows for pay differentials where based on a merit system. So if you are doing annual reviews of an employees and you find, you know, you're consistently reviewing one employee's work performance, then this bill allows pay differential based on that. I think it's important to understand that those typical factors that employers often take into account, this bill doesn't change that. I also want to address there seemed to be a concern about burden of proof. And nothing in this law, these amendments to this law, change the current burden of proof that an employer or an employee faces if there's a dispute. There's no difference in that. And if anything, I believe it makes it easier on the employer because the previous version of the law said that a differential in wages was allowed based on good faith factors. And that is a very unclear, sort of fuzzy standard, what is good faith. And an employer might believe that they're acting in good faith, and then somebody representing an employee come in and show that there's these very real reasons why that wasn't based on good faith. But this gives giving the clarity of the exact reasons why you can make pay differentials really actually makes the employer's burden of proof easier. They know what they can and can't do. Let's see. I also think it's important to understand that the law doesn't prevent you from ever talking to a prospective employee about wages. You can negotiate wages, you can take into account market factors, you can discuss preferences in wages. After you make an offer, you can have further conversations about salary. It simply requires an employer to not make that initial offer by looking at what their previous salary or wages were. And lastly, I want to just add that that this bill does add to the existing protections against discrimination. Of course, there is law that protects against discrimination. I don't disagree with that, but this adds additional levels of protection that are important. For example, the salary history that doesn't currently exist, Another example is that it includes, it makes sure that compensations includes wages, salary, fringe benefit. It takes into account the whole compensation, and it makes that very clear. So that's an additional level of protection, an example of one in the law. So I thank you for the opportunity to address those concerns and provide that additional clarification about what the law does and doesn't do.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Any questions? Not seeing any. Thank you very much for your testimony. Was there anyone else that wanted to testify on House Bill 2005?
Can I testify?
You haven't signed up. No, go ahead.
No, you can't.
You didn't really have to go down there, but since you're down there.
I didn't know that. He told me that. He gave me the hand.
I thought I'd wait till you got down there for
it. Well, anyway, thank you. I wasn't planning on doing this, but after the last testifier, I thought I would. So, Greg Barreto, State Rep, House District 58, for the record, Mr. Chair and committee. You know, I was thinking about this, and we have about 90 employees, and all of them are different. And every single job out in the in the workplace is different. In the office, it's different. The jobs that they do out in the shop, depending on how long they've been there, their skill level, their work ethic, and I was just thinking of their willingness to do anything that you ask them to. And this came up with a discussion that happened just a few weeks ago, and I called my supervisor, and he just told me, you know, he's having trouble with a couple guys, and he said, you know, he had to go out and explain to them, you know, why they wanted raises, and he said, I can't give you a raise because you haven't earned it yet. And you know, there was some discussion, and he said, well, let me explain to you what it's like. And he just grabbed someone else, and he said, hey, would you go over to the other shop and do this, you know, menial task? And the guy said, sure. He said, when do you want me to go? He said, right now. And he said, now, if I'd asked you to do that, you wouldn't have done that. You know, there's an attitude, and Janelle's moving, or nodding her head. And when you do this, and there's always tensions in a large area or in a large shop where you have a lot of employees, and there's tensions whether they think they're being paid right, whether they how they compare to the guy next to them, someone else, and by and large, we all have a higher opinion of ourselves than maybe what other people do, and especially the supervisors. And so there's a tendency to think you're worth more, or you do a better job, or you're getting cheated. And so there's always these opportunities to come back at an employer and say, I wasn't treated right. And just like was mentioned here earlier, then opens the door to litigation, and then the employer ends up having to defend their position. And yeah, maybe they may win, but at any rate, there's a cost to that, whether it's time, whether it's anguish, whether it's dollars. And this is what raises the cost of doing business here. So, and I'll take any questions.
Questions for Representative Bynum? You want to ask him a question?
Yes, sir. Thank you for your testimony, Representative Barreto. What does the mega data tell you when you hear the numbers about, you know, African Americans making, I don't know, 70 cents on the dollar? And how do you reconcile that larger, broader data set with what we see in our individual companies? So is it a not in my backyard type of not in my camp, it's not happening here, it must be somewhere else? Is that what you're suggesting, and,
you know,
and that's how we reconcile it?
No, thank you for the question, Mr. Chair, Representative Bynum. Okay. No, it doesn't. But it tells me there's a disparity out there, I think, in maybe opportunity early on, you know, to where that disparity early on leads to a shortcoming when they get out into the workforce, where that opportunity isn't quite there because they weren't taught the tools early on to meet that level. Is that what you're talking about? I mean, why the disparity between wages or opportunity or unemployment? I think those come from, if I could be real frank, just a breakdown in a family, not necessarily in this black community or over here in this Hispanic community, but you see this throughout the nation. We have a breakdown in the family that affects our graduation rates. It affects the quality of character, I think, that we're getting at the workplace level. And when you talk to people over in our area, I think it's prevalent all over. And a lot of companies say, if we could just find the right people, or the people that wanted to work, or the people with the right character, we have jobs available. And that happens right in LaGrande. There's a motorhome company there that said, we could put on another line and we could put on another 100 people, but we don't have 100 people here that want to work. And granted, it's not the best pay. It's not the best work environment. But nevertheless, it is a job. So.
Thank you.
I will be brief, Chair.
I should never have allowed this. Representative Hack.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. Representative Bretto, I have a quick question for you. It goes back to my comments made about being careful how we blaze a trail, because this is a really important issue for women. If we put so many confinements on business, so many restrictions on business as it relates to women, in your opinion as a business owner, would that hinder business from wanting to hire women?
Oh, sure. I mean, if you open, Mr. Chair, Rep. Hack, if you open up the door for that opportunity to get discriminated against as an employer because of hiring someone that, like you say, has more opportunity to come back and litigate against you, then I think absolutely. But I guess I don't think about, I mean, we don't think about that when we hire, though. I mean, you do to an extent because it's always there, but the other side of it is you don't concern yourself with it. If you hire people, you do the interviews, you qualify them, you tell them what the job is. We have an employee's manual, which is something that, you know, in the wage theft thing the other day, I thought this a lot would be cleared up if you just had an employee manual that you had them sign when you hire them. But some of these things, I think, just like the Small Business Administration that we voted on today on the floor, a lot of those things can help businesses do a better job of running their business and help in this situation here if they just were organized that way to where they had things laid out. But many times in business, you get so busy doing the business, you get so busy in the process of just trying to make ends meet that a lot of those things, especially in smaller business, get put by the wayside and finally get to a point where they're needed, you know, rather than being formatted in the beginning. So.
Representative Hurd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's not a question for you, Representative. It's more of a statement. This conversation and this bill, it makes me think about, I mean, I have no doubt that this kind of discrimination against the ladies has happened and continues to happen. To what severity and where it's happening, I don't have enough information in front of me to absolutely know to pinpoint where that needs to be focused on the most for the legislature to make, you know, changes to the law and whatnot. But for myself, as someone who, I think we've all experienced discrimination in one form or another in our lives. Some of us absolutely more than others. Absolutely. Myself, I that's why I tended to want to go into business for myself. I didn't want to work for my dad. I wanted to go out and determine my own pay. Customers could choose or not choose me. I think part of the broader discussion around House Bill 2005 that needs to be brought up is, I think the state of Oregon and the federal government, for that matter, need to do a better job of getting out of the way of individuals, whether it's folks from different ethnicities, different genders, and what have you, different education levels, so that the barriers of entry can be lowered. Representative Bynum and I are working on such a bill that is focused on helping folks that are disproportionately affected in the Hispanic community from achieving their own entrepreneurial endeavors. That way, we can all choose as Americans and Oregonians who we do or don't do business with. There's always going to be a need for quality, high skill, good folks in the employee side of things. But I'd really like us to, at some point, get back to the other side of it, which is making it easier for folks, whoever you are, whatever you are, to actually determine whether you want to work for someone or not work for someone. So I think that's a part of the discussion that's somewhat missing here, is that the barrier of entry is just too high and too costly, I think, at this point. So,
all right, thank you. I think we're done with you. I will note that the
me or
before
him.
You leave, you know, just because I have just 2 minutes and I don't want a response, but I think under the bill, you know, you were describing this worker that, you know, just hadn't earned anything. I think under the bill, you can, you know, have a different wage rate based on merit. So. You know, just I point that out to you on your way back, but I didn't want a response.
Can I
have
respond
to do a work
to that?
Session?
No.
No, we have to go to committee.
the wonderful ability of that. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2005. Committee, we're going to have just a really, we're going to open a work session on House Bill 2736. Jan, can you describe what we're doing with this?
Yes, Mr. Chair and committee members, this is another man.
Just a second.
Which I think is a good idea.
Can you take your conversations outside so we can finish this on the record? Thank you.
This is a bill that the committee has not heard, and it was determined that the bill should be referred to the House Committee on Economic Development and Trade instead of this committee. So the chair would like it moved without recommendation to that committee. We have the proper paperwork from the Fiscal and the Revenue Office to do so.
Thank you. I'd make the motion. Representative Barreto.
Chair Holby, I move House Bill 2736 without recommendation as passage and to be referred to the Committee on Economic Development and Trade.
Representative Barreto moves House Bill 2736 without recommendation as to passage and be referred to the Committee on Economic Development and Trade. Is there discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, we will move the bill. And it passes. The motion passes. I'll close the work session, House Bill 2736. Anything else for the agenda, Jan?
No,
that's
just thank you.
All right. With that, I will close the adjourn the House Committee on Business and Labor.
Margaret.
We've talked about labor.
Margaret.